means by which these sources are opened to all and rendered equally advantageous to the several districts. The North, which ships the produce of the Anglo-Americans to all parts of the world and brings back the produce of the globe to the Union, is evidently interested in maintaining the Confederation in its present condition, in order that the number of American producers and consumers may remain as large as possible. The North is the most natural agent of communication between the South and the West of the Union on the one hand, and the rest of the world upon the other. The North is therefore interested in the Union and prosperity of the South and the West, in order that they may continue to furnish raw materials for its manufactures and cargoes for its shipping. The South and West, on their side, are still more directly interested to the preservation of the Union and the prosperity of the North. The produce of the South is, for the most part, exported beyond seas. The South and the West consequently stand in need of the commercial resources of the North. They are likewise interested in the maintenance of a powerful fleet by the Union to protect them efficaciously. The South and the West have no vessels, but they cannot refuse a willing subsidy to defray the expenses of the Navy. For if the fleets of Europe were to blockade the ports of the South and the Delta of the Mississippi, what would become of the rice of the Carolinas, the tobacco of Virginia, and the sugar and cotton which grow in the valley of the Mississippi? Every portion of the federal budget does therefore contribute to the maintenance of material interests which are common to all the Confederate States. Independently of this commercial utility, the South and the West of the Union derive great political advantages from their connection with the North. The South contains an enormous slave population, a population which is already alarming and still more formidable for the future. The States of the West lie in the remotest parts of a single valley, and all the rivers which intersect their territory rise in the Rocky Mountains or in the Alleghenies and fall into the Mississippi, which bear them onwards to the Gulf of Mexico. The Western States are consequently entirely cut off by their position from the traditions of Europe and the civilization of the Old World. The inhabitants of the South, then, are induced to support the Union in order to avail themselves of its protection against the blacks, and the inhabitants of the West, in order not to be excluded from a free communication with the rest of the globe and shut up in the wilds of Central America. The North cannot but desire the maintenance of the Union in order to remain, as it now is, the connecting link between that vast body and the other parts of the world. The temporal interests of all the several parts of the Union are then intimately connected, and the same assertion holds true respecting those opinions and sentiments which may be termed the immaterial interests of men. The inhabitants of the United States talk a great deal of their attachment to their country. But I confess that I do not rely upon that calculating patriotism which is founded upon interest and which a change in the interests at stake may obliterate. Nor do I attach much importance to the language of the Americans when they manifest in their daily conversations the intention of maintaining the federal system adopted by their forefathers. A government retains its sway over a great number of citizens, far less by the voluntary and rational consent of the multitude than by that instinctive and, to a certain extent, involuntary agreement which results from similarity of feelings and resemblances of opinion. I will never admit that men constitute a social body simply because they obey the same head and the same laws. Society can only exist when a great number of men consider a great number of things in the same point of view, when they hold the same opinions upon many subjects, and when the same occurrences suggest the same thoughts and impressions to their minds. The observer who examines the present condition of the United States upon this principle will readily discover that although the citizens are divided into 24 distinct sovereignties, they nevertheless constitute a single people. And he may perhaps be led to think that the state of the Anglo-American Union is more truly a state of society than that of certain nations of Europe which live under the same legislation and the same prince. Although the Anglo-Americans have several religious sects, they all regard religion in the same manner. They are not always agreed upon the measures which are most conducive to good government, and they vary upon some of the forms of government which it is expedient to adopt. but they are unanimous upon the general principles which ought to rule human society. From Maine to the Floridas, and from the Missouri to the Atlantic Ocean, the people is held to be the legitimate source of all power. The same notions are entertained respecting liberty and equality, the liberty of the press, the right of association, the jury, and the responsibility of the agents of government. If we turn from their political and religious opinions to the moral and philosophical principles which regulate the daily actions of life and govern their conduct, we shall still find the same uniformity. The Anglo-Americans acknowledge the absolute moral authority of the reason of the community, as they acknowledge the political authority of the mass of citizens. And they hold that public opinion is the surest arbiter of what is lawful or forbidden, true or false. Author's note: it is scarcely necessary for me to observe that by the expression Anglo-Americans, I only mean to designate the great majority of the nation. For a certain number of isolated individuals are, of course, to be met with, holding very different opinions. The majority of them believe that a man will be led to do what is just and good by following his own interest, rightly understood. They hold that every man is born in possession of the right of self-government, and that no one has the right of constraining his fellow creatures to be happy. They have all a lively faith in the perfectibility of man. They are of opinion that the effects of the diffusion of knowledge must necessarily be advantageous, and the consequences of ignorance fatal. They all consider society as a body in a state of improvement, humanity as a changing scene, in which nothing is or ought to be permanent. And they admit that what appears to them to be good today may be superseded by something better tomorrow. I do not give all these opinions as true, but I quote them as characteristic of the Americans. The Anglo-Americans are not only united by these common opinions, but they are separated from all other nations by a common feeling of pride. For the last 50 years, no pains have been spared to convince the inhabitants of the United States that they constitute the only religious, enlightened, and free people. They perceive that, for the present, their own democratic institutions succeed, whilst those of other countries fail. Hence, they conceive an overweening opinion of their superiority, and they are not very remote from believing themselves to belong to a distinct race of mankind. The dangers which threaten the American Union do not originate in the diversity of interests or of opinions, but in the various characters and passions of the Americans. The men who inhabit the vast territories of the United States are almost all the issue of a common stock. But the effects of the climate, and more especially of slavery, have gradually introduced very striking differences between the British settler of the southern states and the British settler of the north. In Europe, it is generally believed that slavery has rendered the interests of one part of the Union contrary to those of another part. But I by no means remarked this to be the case. Slavery has not created interests in the South contrary to those of the North, but it has modified the character and changed the habits of the natives of the South. I have already explained the influence which slavery has exercised upon the commercial ability of the Americans in the South, and this same influence equally extends to their manners. The slave is a servant who never remonstrates and who submits to everything without complaint. He may sometimes assassinate, but he never withstands his master. In the South, there are no families so poor as not to have slaves. The citizen of the southern states of the Union is invested with a sort of domestic dictatorship from his earliest years. The first notion he acquires in life is that he is born to command, and the first habit which he contracts is that of being obeyed without resistance. His education tends, then, to give him the character of a supercilious and a hasty man, irascible, violent, and ardent in his desires, impatient of obstacles, but easily discouraged if he cannot succeed upon his first attempt. The American of the northern states is surrounded by no slaves in his childhood. He is even unattended by free servants, and is usually obliged to provide for his own wants. No sooner does he enter the world than the idea of necessity assails him on every side. He soon learns to know exactly the natural limit of his authority. He never expects to subdue those who withstand him by force. and he knows that the surest means of obtaining the support of his fellow creatures is to win their favor. He therefore becomes patient, reflecting, tolerant, slow to act, and persevering in his designs. In the southern states, the more immediate wants of life are always supplied. The inhabitants of those parts are not busied in the material cares of life, which are always provided for by others, and their imagination is diverted to more captivating and less definite objects. The American of the South is fond of grandeur, luxury, and renown, of gaiety, of pleasure, and above all, of idleness. Nothing obliges him to exert himself in order to subsist, and as he has no necessary occupations, he gives way to indolence, and does not even attempt what would be useful. But the equality of fortunes and the absence of slavery in the North plunge the inhabitants in those same cares of daily life which are disdained by the white population of the South. They are taught from infancy to combat want and to place comfort above all the pleasures of the intellect or the heart. The imagination is extinguished by the trivial details of life, and the ideas become less numerous and less general, but far more practical and more precise. As prosperity is the sole aim of exertion, it is excellently well attained. Nature and mankind are turned to the best pecuniary advantage, and society is dexterously made to contribute to the welfare of each of its members, whilst individual egotism is the source of general happiness. The citizen of the North has not only experience, but knowledge. Nevertheless, he sets but little value upon the pleasures of knowledge. He esteems it as the means of attaining a certain end, and he is only anxious to seize its more lucrative applications. The citizen of the South is more to act upon impulse. He is more clever, more frank, more generous, more intellectual, and more brilliant. The former, with a greater degree of activity, of common sense, of information, and of general aptitude, has the characteristic good and evil qualities of the middle classes. The latter has the tastes, the prejudices, the weaknesses, and the magnanimity of all aristocracies. If two men are united in society, who have the same interests and to a certain extent the same opinions, but different characters, different acquirements, and a different style of civilization, it is probable that these men will not agree. The same remark is applicable to a society of nations. Slavery, then, does not attack the American Union directly in its interests, but indirectly in its manners. The states which gave their assent to the federal contract in 1790 were 13 in number. The Union now consists of 34 members. The population, which amounted to nearly 4 million in 1790, had more than tripled in the space of 40 years, and in 1830 it amounted to nearly 13 million. Changes of such magnitude cannot take place without some danger. A society of nations, as well as a society of individuals, derives its principal chances of duration from the wisdom of its members, their individual weakness, and their limited number. The Americans who quit the coasts of the Atlantic Ocean to plunge into the Western wilderness are adventurers impatient of restraint, greedy of wealth, and frequently men expelled from the states in which they were born. When they arrive in the deserts, they are unknown to each other, and they have neither traditions, family feeling, nor the force of example to check their excesses. The empire of the laws is feeble amongst them. That of morality is still more powerless. The settlers who are constantly peopling the valley of the Mississippi are then, in every respect, very inferior to the Americans who inhabit the older parts of the Union. Nevertheless, they already exercise a great influence in its councils, and they arrive at the government of the Commonwealth before they have learnt to govern themselves. Author's note: this indeed is only a temporary danger. I have no doubt that in time society will assume as much stability and regularity in the West as it has already done upon the coast of the Atlantic Ocean. The greater the individual weakness of each of the contracting parties, the greater are the chances of the duration of the contract, for their safety is then dependent upon their union. When, in 1790, the most populous of the American republics did not contain 500,000 inhabitants, Pennsylvania contained 431,373 inhabitants in 1790, each of them felt its own insignificance as an independent people, and this feeling rendered compliance with the federal authority more easy. But when one of the Confederate states reckons, like the state of New York, 2 million of inhabitants and covers an extent of territory equal in surface to a quarter of France, the area of the state of New York is 49,170 square miles, it feels its own strength. And although it may continue to support the Union as advantageous to its prosperity, it no longer regards that body as necessary to its existence. And as it continues to belong to the federal compact, it soon aims at preponderance in the federal assemblies. The probable unanimity of the states is diminished as their number increases. At present, the interests of the different parts of the Union are not at variance. But who was able to foresee the multifarious changes of the future? In a country in which towns are founded from day to day and states almost from year to year. Since the first settlement of the British colonies, the number of inhabitants has about doubled every 22 years. I perceive no causes which are likely to check this progressive increase of the Anglo-American population for the next 100 years. And before that space of time has elapsed, I believe that the territories and dependencies of the United States will be covered by more than 100 million of inhabitants and divided into 40 states. Author's note: if the population continues to double every 22 years, as it had done for the last 200 years, the number of inhabitants in the United States in 1852 will be 20 millions. In 1874, 48 millions. And in 1896, 96 millions. This may still be the case even if the lands on the western slope of the Rocky Mountains should be found to be unfit for cultivation. The territory which is already occupied can easily contain this number of inhabitants. 100 millions of men disseminated over the surface of the 24 states and the 3 dependencies which constitute the Union would only give 762 inhabitants to the square league. This would be far below the mean population of France, which is 1,063 to the square league, or of England, which is 1,457. And it would even be below the population of Switzerland, for that country, notwithstanding its lakes and mountains, contains 783 inhabitants to the square league. I admit that these 100 million of men have no hostile interests. I suppose, on the contrary, that they are all equally interested in the maintenance of the Union. But I am still of the opinion that where there are 100 million of men and 40 distinct nations unequally strong, the continuance of the federal government can only be a fortunate accident. Whatever faith I may have in the perfectibility of man until human nature is altered and men wholly transformed, I shall refuse to believe in the duration of a government which is called upon to hold together 40 different peoples disseminated over a territory equal to one half of Europe in extent, to avoid all rivalry, ambition, and struggles between them, and to direct their independent activity to the accomplishment of the same designs. But the greatest peril to which the Union is exposed by its increases arises from the continual changes which take place in the position of its internal strength. The distance from Lake Superior to the Gulf of Mexico extends from the 47th to the 30th degree of latitude, a distance of more than 1,200 miles as the bird flies. The frontier of the United States winds along the whole of this immense line, sometimes falling within its limits, but more frequently extending far beyond it into the waste. It has been calculated that the whites advance every year a mean distance of 17 miles along the whole of his vast boundary. Obstacles, such as an unproductive district, a lake, or an Indian nation unexpectedly encountered, are sometimes met with. The advancing column then halts for a while. Its two extremities fall back upon themselves, and as soon as they are reunited, they proceed onwards. This gradual and continuous progression of the European race towards the Rocky Mountains has the solemnity of a providential event. It is like a deluge of men rising unabatedly and daily driven onwards by the hand of God. Within this first line of conquering settlers, towns are built and vast states founded. In 1790, there were only a few thousand pioneers sprinkled along the valleys of the Mississippi. And at the present day, these valleys contain as many inhabitants as were to be found in the whole Union in 1790. Their population amounts to nearly 4 million. 3,672,317, census of 1830. The city of Washington was founded in 1800 in the very center of the Union, but such are the changes which have taken place that it now stands at one of the extremities. And the delegates of the most remote western states are already obliged to perform a journey as long as that from Vienna to Paris. Author's note: the distance from Jefferson, the capital of the state of Missouri, to Washington is 1,019 miles. All the states are borne onwards at the same time in the path of fortune, but of course they do not all increase and prosper in the same proportion. To the north of the Union, the detached branches of the Allegheny chain, which extend as far as the Atlantic Ocean, form spacious roads and ports, which are constantly accessible to vessels of the greatest burden. But from the Potomac to the mouth of the Mississippi, the coast is sandy and flat. In this part of the Union, the mouths of almost all the rivers are obstructed, and the few harbors which exist amongst these lagoons afford much shallower water to vessels and much fewer commercial advantages than those of the North. This first natural cause of inferiority is united to another cause proceeding from the laws. We have already seen that slavery, which is abolished in the North, still exists in the South, and I have pointed out its fatal consequences upon the prosperity of the planter himself. The North is therefore superior to the South both in commerce and manufacture, the natural consequences of which is the more rapid increase of population and of wealth within its borders. Author's note: the following statements will suffice to show the difference which exists between the commerce of the South and that of the North. In 1829, the tonnage of all the merchant vessels belonging to Virginia, the two Carolinas, and Georgia, the four great southern states, amounted to only 5,243 tons. In the same year, the tonnage of the vessels of the state of Massachusetts alone amounted to 17,322 tons. Thus, the state of Massachusetts had three times as much shipping as the four previously mentioned states. Nevertheless, the area of the state of Massachusetts is only 7,335 square miles, and its population amounts to 610,014 inhabitants, whilst the area of the four other states I have quoted is 210,000 square miles, and their population 3,047,767. Thus, the area of the state of Massachusetts forms only 1/30th part of the area of the four states, and its population is five times smaller than theirs. Slavery is prejudicial to the commercial prosperity of the South in several different ways. By diminishing the spirit of enterprise amongst the whites, and by preventing them from meeting with as numerous a class of sailors as they require. Sailors are usually taken from the lowest ranks of the population, but in the southern states, these lowest ranks are composed of slaves, and it is very difficult to employ them at sea. They are unable to serve as well as a white crew, and apprehensions would always be entertained of their mutinying in the middle of the ocean, or of their escaping in the foreign countries at which they might touch. The states situate upon the shores of the Atlantic Ocean are already half-peopled. Most of the land is held by an owner, and these districts cannot therefore receive so many emigrants as the western states, where a boundless field is still open to their exertions. The valley of the Mississippi is far more fertile than the coast of the Atlantic Ocean. This reason, added to all the others, contributes to drive the Europeans westward, a fact which may be rigorously demonstrated by figures. It is found that the sum total of the population of all the United States has about tripled in the course of 40 years. But in the recent states adjacent to the Mississippi, the population has increased 31-fold within the same space of time. The relative position of the central federal power is continually displaced. 40 years ago, the majority of the citizens of the Union was established upon the coast of the Atlantic, in the environs of the spot upon which Washington now stands. But the great body of the people is now advancing inland and to the north, so that in 20 years the majority will unquestionably be on the western side of the Alleghenies. If the Union goes on to subsist, the basin of the Mississippi is evidently marked out, by its fertility and its extent, as the future center of the federal government. In 30 or 40 years, that tract of country will have assumed the rank which naturally belongs to it. It is easy to calculate that its population, compared to that of the coast of the Atlantic, will be in round numbers as 40 to 11. In a few years, the states which founded the Union will lose the direction of its policy, and the population of the valley of the Mississippi will preponderate in the federal assemblies. This constant gravitation of the federal power and influence towards the Northwest is shown every 10 years when a general census of the population is made, and the number of delegates which each state sends to Congress is settled afresh. Author's note: it may be seen that in the course of the last 10 years, 1820 to 1830, the population of one district, as for instance the state of Delaware, has increased in the proportion of 5%, whilst that of another, as the territory of Michigan, has increased 250%. Thus, the population of Virginia had augmented 13%, and that of the border state of Ohio, 61%, in the same space of time. The general table of these changes, which is given in the National Calendar, displays a striking picture of the unequal fortunes of the different states. In 1790, Virginia had 19 representatives in Congress. This number continued to increase until the year 1813, when it reached to 23. From that time it began to decrease, and in 1833 Virginia elected only 21 representatives. Author's note: it has just been said that in the course of the last term the population of Virginia has increased 13%, and it is necessary to explain how the number of representatives for a state may decrease when the population of that state, far from diminishing, is actually upon the increase. I take the state of Virginia, to which I have already alluded, as my term of comparison. The number of representatives of Virginia in 1823 was proportionate to the total number of the representatives of the Union, and to the relation which the population bore to that of the whole Union. In 1833, the number of representatives of Virginia was likewise proportionate to the total number of the representatives of the Union, and to the relation which its population, augmented in the course of 10 years, bore to the augmented population of the Union in the same space of time. The new number of Virginian representatives will then be to the old number, on the one hand, as the new number of all the representatives is to the old number, and on the other hand, as the augmentation of the population of Virginia is to that of the whole population of the country. Thus, if the increase of the population of the lesser country be to that of the greater in an exact inverse ratio of the proportion between the new and the old numbers of all the representatives, the number of the representatives of Virginia will remain stationary. And if the increase of the Virginian population be to that of the whole Union in a feebler ratio than the new number of the representatives of the Union to the old number, the number of the representatives of Virginia must decrease. During the same period, the state of New York progressed in the contrary direction. In 1790, it had 10 representatives in Congress. In 1813, 27. In 1823, 34. And in 1833, 40. The state of Ohio had only one representative in 1803, and in 1833, it had already 19. It is difficult to imagine a durable union of a people which is rich and strong with one which is poor and weak, even if it were proved that the strength and wealth of the one are not the causes of the weakness and poverty of the other. But union is still more difficult to maintain at a time at which one party is losing strength and the other is gaining it. This rapid and disproportionate increase of certain states threatens the independence of the others. New York might perhaps succeed, with its 2 million of inhabitants and its 40 representatives, in dictating to the other states in Congress. But even if the more powerful states make no attempt to bear down the lesser ones, the danger still exists, for there is almost as much in the possibility of the act as in the act itself. The weak generally mistrust the justice and the reason of the strong. The states which increase less rapidly than the others look upon those which are more favored by fortune with envy and suspicion. Hence arise the deep-seated uneasiness and ill-defined agitation which are observable in the South, and which form so striking a contrast to the confidence and prosperity which are common to the other parts of the Union. I am inclined to think that the hostile measures taken by the southern provinces upon a recent occasion are attributable to no other cause. The inhabitants of the southern states are, of all the Americans, those who are most interested in the maintenance of the Union. They would assuredly suffer most from being left to themselves, and yet they are the only citizens who threaten to break the tie of confederation. But it is easy to perceive that the South, which has given four presidents, Washington, Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe, to the Union, which perceives that it is losing its federal influence, and that the number of its representatives in Congress is diminishing from year to year, whilst those of the northern and western states are increasing, the South, which is peopled with ardent and irascible beings, is becoming more and more irritated and alarmed. The citizens reflect upon their present position and remember their past influence with the melancholy uneasiness of men who suspect oppression. If they discover a law of the Union which is not unequivocally favorable to their interests, they protest against it as an abuse of force. And if their ardent remonstrances are not listened to, they threaten to quit an association which loads them with burdens, whilst it deprives them of their due profits. The tariff, said the inhabitants of Carolina in 1832, enriches the North and ruins the South. For if this were not the case, to what can we attribute the continually increasing power and wealth of the North, with its inclement skies and arid soil? Whilst the South, which may be styled the Garden of America, is rapidly declining. If the changes which I have described were gradual, so that each generation at least might have time to disappear with the order of things under which it had lived, the danger would be less. But the progress of society in America is precipitate and almost revolutionary. The same citizen may have lived to see his state take the lead in the Union and afterwards become powerless in the federal assemblies. And an Anglo-American Republican has been known to grow as rapidly as a man passing from birth and infancy to maturity in the course of 30 years. It must not be imagined, however, that the states which lose their preponderance also lose their population or their riches. No stop is put to their prosperity, and they even go on to increase more rapidly than any kingdom in Europe. Author's note: the population of a country assuredly constitutes the first element of its wealth. In the 10 years, 1820 to 1830, during which Virginia lost two of its representatives in Congress, its population increased in the proportion of 13.7%, that of Carolina in the proportion of 15%, and that of Georgia 15.5%. But the population of Russia, which increases more rapidly than that of any other European country, only augments in 10 years at the rate of 9.5%, in France at the rate of 7%, and in Europe in general at the rate of 4.7%. But they believe themselves to be impoverished because their wealth does not augment as rapidly as that of their neighbors, and they think that their power is lost because they suddenly come into collision with a power greater than their own. Thus they are more hurt in their feelings and their passions than in their interests. Author's note: it must be admitted, however, that the depreciation which has taken place in the value of tobacco during the last 50 years has notably diminished the opulence of the southern planters. But this circumstance is as independent of the will of their northern brethren as it is of their own. But this is amply sufficient to endanger the maintenance of the Union. If kings and peoples had only had their true interests in view ever since the beginning of the world, the name of war would scarcely be known among mankind. Thus, the prosperity of the United States is the source of the most serious dangers that threaten them, since it tends to create in some of the Confederate states that overexcitement which accompanies a rapid increase of fortune. and to awaken in others those feelings of envy, mistrust, and regret which usually attend upon the loss of it. The Americans contemplate this extraordinary and hasty progress with exultation, but they would be wiser to consider it with sorrow and alarm. The Americans of the United States must inevitably become one of the greatest nations in the world. Their offset will cover almost the whole of North America. The continent which they inhabit is their dominion, and it cannot escape them. What urges them to take possession of it so soon? Riches, power, and renown cannot fail to be theirs at some future time, but they rush upon their fortune as if but a moment remained for them to make it their own. I think that I have demonstrated that the existence of the present Confederation depends entirely on the continued ascent of all the Confederates. And, starting from this principle, I have inquired into the causes which may induce the several states to separate from the others. The Union may, however, perish in two different ways. One of the Confederate states may choose to retire from the compact, and so forcibly to sever the federal tie. And it is to this supposition that most of the remarks that I have made apply. Or the authority of the federal government may be progressively entrenched on by the simultaneous tendency of the United Republics to resume their independence. The central power, successively stripped of all its prerogatives and reduced to impotence by tacit consent, would become incompetent to fulfill its purpose. And the second union would perish, like the first, by a sort of senile inaptitude. The gradual weakening of the federal tie, which may finally lead to the dissolution of the Union, is a distinct circumstance that may produce a variety of minor consequences before it operates so violent a change. The Confederation might still subsist, although its government were reduced to such a degree of inanition as to paralyze the nation, to cause internal anarchy, and to check the general prosperity of the country. After having investigated the causes which may induce the Anglo-Americans to disunite, it is important to inquire whether, if the Union continues to subsist, their government will extend or contract its sphere of action, and whether it will become more energetic or more weak. The Americans are evidently disposed to look upon their future condition with alarm. They perceive that, in most of the nations of the world, the exercise of the rights of sovereignty tends to fall under the control of a few individuals, and they are dismayed by the idea that such will also be the case in their own country. Even the statesmen feel, or affect to feel, these fears, for, in America, centralization is by no means popular, and there is no surer means of courting the majority than by inveighing against the encroachments of the central power. The Americans do not perceive that the countries in which this alarming tendency to centralize exists are inhabited by a single people. Whilst the fact of the Union being composed of different Confederate communities is sufficient to baffle all the inferences which might be drawn from analogous circumstances. I confess that I am inclined to consider the fears of a great number of Americans as purely imaginary. And far from participating in their dread of the consolidation of power in the hands of the Union, I think that the federal government is visibly losing strength. To prove this assertion, I shall not have recourse to any remote occurrences, but to circumstances which I have myself witnessed, and which belong to our own time. An attentive examination of what is going on in the United States will easily convince us that two opposite tendencies exist in that country, like two distinct currents flowing in contrary directions in the same channel. The Union has now existed for 45 years, and in the course of that time a vast number of provincial prejudices which were at first hostile to its power have died away. The patriotic feeling which attached each of the Americans to his own native state is become less exclusive, and the different parts of the Union have become more intimately connected the better they have become acquainted with each other. The post, that great instrument of intellectual intercourse, now reaches into the backwoods, and steamboats have established daily means of communication between the different points of the coast. Author's note: in 1832, the District of Michigan, which only contains 31,639 inhabitants and is still in almost unexplored wilderness, possessed 940 miles of mail roads. The territory of Arkansas, which is still more uncultivated, was already intersected by 1,938 miles of mail roads. The postage of newspapers alone in the whole Union amounted to $254,796. An inland navigation of unexampled rapidity conveys commodities up and down the rivers of the country. Author's note: in the course of 10 years, from 1821 to 1831, 271 steamboats have been launched upon the rivers which water the valley of the Mississippi alone. In 1829, 259 steamboats existed in the United States. And to these facilities of nature and art may be added those restless cravings, that busy-mindedness and love of pelf, which are constantly urging the American into active life and bringing him into contact with his fellow citizens. He crosses the country in every direction. He visits all the various populations of the land. And there is not a province in France in which the natives are so well known to each other as the 13 million of men who cover the territory of the United States. But whilst the Americans intermingle, they grow in resemblance of each other. The differences resulting from their climate, their origin, and their institutions diminish, and they all draw nearer and nearer to the common type. Every year, thousands of men leave the North to settle in different parts of the Union. They bring with them their faith, their opinions, and their manners. And as they are more enlightened than the men amongst whom they are about to dwell, they soon rise to the head of affairs, and they adapt society to their own advantage. This continual emigration of the North to the South is peculiarly favorable to the fusion of all the different provincial characters into one national character. The civilization of the North appears to be the common standard to which the whole nation will one day be assimilated. Commercial ties which unite the Confederate States are strengthened by increasing manufactures of the Americans, and the Union which began to exist in their opinions gradually forms a part of their habits. The course of time has swept away the bugbear thoughts which haunted the imaginations of the citizens in 1789. The federal power is not become oppressive. It has not destroyed the independence of the states. It has not subjected the Confederates to monarchical institutions. And the Union has not rendered the lesser states dependent upon the larger ones. But the Confederation has continued to increase in population, in wealth, and in power. I am therefore convinced that the natural obstacles to the continuance of the American Union are not so powerful at the present time as they were in 1789, and that the enemies of the Union are not so numerous. Nevertheless, a careful examination of the history of the United States for the last 45 years will readily convince us that the federal power is declining. Nor is it difficult to explain the causes of this phenomenon. When the Constitution of 1789 was promulgated, the nation was a prey to anarchy. The Union, which succeeded this confusion, excited much dread and much animosity, but it was warmly supported because it satisfied an imperious want. Thus, although it was more attacked than it is now, the federal power soon reached the maximum of its authority, as is usually the case with a government which triumphs after having braced its strength by the struggle. At that time, the interpretation of the Constitution seemed to extend rather than to repress the federal sovereignty, and the Union offered, in several respects, the appearance of a single and undivided people, directed in its foreign and internal policy by a single government. But to attain this point, the people had risen, to a certain extent, above itself. The Constitution had not destroyed the distinct sovereignty of the states, and all communities, of whatever nature they may be, are impelled by a secret propensity to assert their independence. This propensity is still more decided in a country like America, in which every village forms a sort of republic accustomed to conduct its own affairs. It therefore cost the states an effort to submit to the federal supremacy, and all efforts, however successful they may be, necessarily subside with the causes in which they originated. As the federal government consolidated its authority, America resumed its rank amongst the nations, peace returned to its frontiers, and public credit was restored. Confusion was succeeded by a fixed state of things, which was favorable to the full and free exercise of industrious enterprise. It was this very prosperity which made the Americans forget the cause to which it was attributable, and when once the danger was past, the energy and the patriotism which had enabled them to brave it disappeared from amongst them. No sooner were they delivered from the cares which oppressed them than they easily returned to their ordinary habits and gave themselves up without resistance to their natural inclinations. When a powerful government no longer appeared to be necessary, they once more began to think it irksome. The Union encouraged a general prosperity, and the states were not inclined to abandon the Union. But they desired to render the action of the power which represented that body as light as possible. The general principle of union was adopted, but in every minor detail there was an actual tendency to independence. The principle of confederation was every day more easily admitted and more rarely applied, so that the federal government brought about its own decline whilst it was creating order and peace. As soon as this tendency of public opinion began to be manifested externally, the leaders of parties who live by the passions of the people began to work it to their own advantage. The position of the federal government then became exceedingly critical. Its enemies were in possession of the popular favor, and they obtained the right of conducting its policy by pledging themselves to lessen its influence. From that time forwards, the government of the Union has invariably been obliged to recede, as often as it has attempted to enter the lists with the governments of the states. And whenever an interpretation of the terms of the federal constitution has been called for, that interpretation has most frequently been opposed to the Union and favorable to the states. The constitution invested the federal government with the right of providing for the interests of the nation, and it had been held that no other authority was so fit to superintend the internal improvements which affected the prosperity of the whole Union, such, for instance, as the cutting of canals. But the states were alarmed at a power distinct from their own, which could thus dispose of a portion of their territory. And they were afraid that the central government would by this means acquire a formidable extent of patronage within their own confines, and exercise a degree of influence which they intended to reserve exclusively to their own agents. The Democratic Party, which has constantly been opposed to the increase of the federal authority, then accused the Congress of usurpation and the chief magistrate of ambition. The central government was intimidated by the opposition, and it soon acknowledged its error, promising exactly to confine its influence for the future within the circle which was prescribed to it. The Constitution confers upon the Union the right of treating with foreign nations. The Indian tribes, which border upon the frontiers of the United States, had usually been regarded in this light. As long as these savages consented to retire before the civilized settlers, the federal right was not contested. But as soon as an Indian tribe attempted to fix its dwelling upon a given spot, the adjacent states claimed possession of the lands and the rights of sovereignty over the natives. The central government soon recognized both these claims, and after it had concluded treaties with the Indians as independent nations, it gave them up as subjects to the legislative tyranny of the states. Some of the states, which had been founded upon the coast of the Atlantic, extended indefinitely to the west, into wild regions where no European had ever penetrated. The states whose confines were irrevocably fixed looked with a jealous eye upon the unbounded regions which the future would enable their neighbors to explore. The latter then agreed, with a view to conciliate the others and to facilitate the act of union, to lay down their own boundaries and to abandon all the territory which lay beyond those limits to the Confederation at large. Author's note: the first act of cession was made by the state of New York in 1780. Virginia, Massachusetts, Connecticut, South and North Carolina followed this example at different times, and lastly, the act of cession of Georgia was made as recently as 1802. Thenceforward, the federal government became the owner of all the uncultivated lands which lie beyond the borders of the 13 states first confederated. It was invested with the right of parceling and selling them, and the sums derived from this source were exclusively reserved to the public treasure of the Union, in order to furnish supplies for purchasing tracts of country from the Indians, for opening roads to the remote settlements, and for accelerating the increase of civilization as much as possible. New states have, however, been formed in the course of time, in the midst of those wilds which were formerly ceded by the inhabitants of the shores of the Atlantic. Congress has gone on to sell, for the profit of the nation at large, the uncultivated lands which those new states contained. But the latter at length asserted that, as they were now fully constituted, they ought to enjoy the exclusive right of converting the produce of these sales to their own use. As their remonstrances became more and more threatening, Congress thought fit to deprive the Union of a portion of the privileges which it had hitherto enjoyed. And at the end of 1832, it passed a law by which the greatest part of the revenue derived from the sale of lands was made over to the new Western republics, although the lands themselves were not ceded to them. Author's note: it is true that the President refused his assent to this law, but he completely adopted it in principle. The slightest observation in the United States enables one to appreciate the advantages which the country derives from the bank. These advantages are of several kinds, but one of them is peculiarly striking to the stranger. The banknotes of the United States are taken upon the borders of the desert for the same value as at Philadelphia, where the bank conducts its operations. Author's note: the present Bank of the United States was established in 1816 with a capital of $35 million. Its charter expires in 1836. Last year, Congress passed a law to renew it, but the President put his veto upon the bill. The struggle is still going on with great violence on either side, and the speedy fall of the bank may easily be foreseen. The Bank of the United States is nevertheless the object of great animosity. Its directors have proclaimed their hostility to the President, and they are accused, not without some show of probability, of having abused their influence to thwart his election. The President, therefore, attacks the establishment which they represent with all the warmth of personal enmity, and he is encouraged in the pursuit of his revenge by the conviction that he is supported by the secret propensities of the majority. The bank may be regarded as the great monetary tie of the Union, just as Congress is the great legislative tie, and the same passions which tend to render the states independent of the central power contribute to the overthrow of the bank. The Bank of the United States always holds a great number of the notes issued by the provincial banks, which it can at any time oblige them to convert into cash. It has itself nothing to fear from a similar demand, as the extent of its resources enables it to meet all claims. But the existence of the provincial banks is thus threatened, and their operations are restricted, since they are only able to issue a quantity of notes duly proportioned to their capital. They submit with impatience to this salutary control. The newspapers which they have bought over, and the President, whose interest renders him their instrument, attack the bank with the greatest vehemence. They rouse the local passions and the blind democratic instinct of the country to aid their cause, and they assert that the bank directors form a permanent aristocratic body, whose influence must ultimately be felt in the government, and must affect those principles of equality upon which society rests in America. The contest between the bank and its opponents is only an incident in the great struggle which is going on in America between the provinces and the central power, between the spirit of democratic independence and the spirit of gradation and subordination. I do not mean that the enemies of the bank are identically the same individuals who, on other points, attack the federal government. But I assert that the attacks directed against the Bank of the United States originate in the same propensities which militate against the federal government, and that the very numerous opponents of the former afford a deplorable symptom of the decreasing support of the latter. The Union has never displayed so much weakness as in the celebrated question of the tariff. The wars of the French Revolution and of 1812 had created manufacturing establishments in the north of the Union, by cutting off all free communication between America and Europe. When peace was concluded, and the channel of intercourse reopened by which the produce of Europe was transmitted to the New World, the Americans thought fit to establish a system of import duties for the twofold purpose of protecting their incipient manufactures and to paying off the amount of the debt contracted during the war. The southern states, which have no manufactures to encourage and which are exclusively agricultural, soon complained of this measure. Such were the simple facts, and I do not pretend to examine in this place whether their complaints were well-founded or unjust. As early as the year 1820, South Carolina declared in a petition to Congress that the tariff was unconstitutional, oppressive, and unjust, and the states of Georgia, Virginia, North Carolina, Alabama, and Mississippi subsequently remonstrated against it with more or less vigor. But Congress, far from lending an ear to these complaints, raised the scale of tariff duties in the years 1824 and 1828, and recognized anew the principle on which it was founded. A doctrine was then proclaimed, or rather revived, in the South, which took the name of nullification. I have shown in the proper place that the object of the Federal Constitution was not to form a league, but to create a national government. The Americans of the United States form a sole and undivided people, in all the cases which are specified by that Constitution. And upon these points the will of the nation is expressed, as it is in all constitutional nations, by the voice of the majority. When the majority has pronounced its decision, it is the duty of the minority to submit. Such is the sound legal doctrine, and the only one which agrees with the text of the Constitution and the known intention of those who framed it. The partisans of nullification in the South maintain, on the contrary, that the intention of the Americans in uniting was not to reduce themselves to the condition of one and the same people, that they meant to constitute a league of independent states, and that each state consequently retains its entire sovereignty, if not de facto, at least de jure, and has the right of putting its own construction upon the laws of Congress, and of suspending their execution within the limits of its own territory, if they are held to be unconstitutional and unjust. The entire doctrine of nullification is comprised in a sentence uttered by Vice President Calhoun, the head of that party in the South, before the Senate of the United States in the year 1833. The Constitution is a compact to which the states were parties in their sovereign capacity. Now, whenever a compact is entered into by parties which acknowledge no tribunal above their authority to decide in the last resort, each of them has a right to judge for itself in relation to the nature, extent, and obligations of the instrument. It is evident that a similar doctrine destroys the very basis of the Federal Constitution and brings back all the evils of the old Confederation, from which the Americans were supposed to have had a safe deliverance. When South Carolina perceived that Congress turned a deaf ear to its remonstrances, it threatened to apply the doctrine of nullification to the federal tariff bill. Congress persisted in its former system, and at length the storm broke out. In the course of 1832, the citizens of South Carolina named a national convention to consult upon the extraordinary measures which they were called upon to take. Author's note, that is to say, the majority of the people, for the opposite party, called the Union Party, always formed a very strong and active minority. Carolina may contain about 47,000 electors. 30,000 were in favor of nullification and 17,000 opposed to it. On November 24th of the same year, this convention promulgated a law under the form of a decree which annulled the federal law of the tariff, forbade the levy of the imposts which that law commands, and refused to recognize the appeal which might be made to the federal courts of law. Author's note, this decree was preceded by a report of the committee by which it was framed, containing the explanation of the motives and object of the law. The following passage occurs in it. When the rights reserved by the Constitution to the different states are deliberately violated, it is the duty and the right of those states to interfere in order to check the progress of the evil, to resist usurpation and to maintain, within their respective limits, those powers and privileges which belong to them as independent sovereign states. If they were destitute of this right, they would not be sovereign. South Carolina declares that she acknowledges no tribunal upon earth above her authority. She has indeed entered into a solemn compact of union with the other states, but she demands and will exercise the right of putting her own construction upon it. And when this compact is violated by her sister states and by the government which they have created, she is determined to avail herself to the unquestionable right of judging what is the extent of the infraction and what are the measures best fitted to obtain justice. This decree was only to be put in execution in the ensuing month of February, and it was intimated that if Congress modified the tariff before that period, South Carolina might be induced to proceed no further with her menaces. And a vague desire was afterwards expressed of submitting the question to an extraordinary assembly of all the Confederate states. In the meantime, South Carolina armed her militia and prepared for war. But Congress, which had slighted its suppliant subjects, listened to their complaints as soon as they were found to have taken up arms. Author's note: Congress was finally decided to take this step by the conduct of the powerful state of Virginia, whose legislature offered to serve as mediator between the Union and South Carolina. Hitherto, the latter state had appeared to be entirely abandoned, even by the states which had joined in her remonstrances. A law passed by which the tariff duties were to be progressively reduced for 10 years until they were brought so low as to not exceed the amount of supplies necessary to the government. This law was passed on March 2, 1833. Thus, Congress completely abandoned the principle of the tariff and substituted a mere fiscal impost to a system of protective duties. Author's note: this bill was brought in by Mr. Clay, and it passed in 4 days through both houses of Congress by an immense majority. The government of the Union, in order to conceal its defeat, had recourse to an expedient which is very much in vogue with feeble governments. It yielded the point de facto, but it remained inflexible upon the principles in question. And whilst Congress was altering the tariff law, it passed another bill by which the President was invested with extraordinary powers, enabling him to overcome by force a resistance which was then no longer to be apprehended. But South Carolina did not consent to leave the Union in the enjoyment of these scanty trophies of success. The same National Convention which had annulled the tariff bill met again and accepted the proffered concession. But at the same time, it declared it unabated perseverance in the doctrine of nullification, and to prove what it said, and annulled the law investing the President with extraordinary powers, although it was very certain that the clauses of that law would never be carried into effect. Almost all the controversies of which I have been speaking have taken place under the presidency of General Jackson, and it cannot be denied that in the question of the tariff, he has supported the claims of the Union with vigor and with skill. I am, however, of opinion that the conduct of the individual who now represents the federal government may be reckoned as one of the dangers which threaten its continuance. Some persons in Europe have formed an opinion of the possible influence of General Jackson upon the affairs of his country, which appears highly extravagant to those who have seen more of the subject. We have been told that General Jackson has won sundry battles, that he is an energetic man, prone by nature and by habit to the use of force, covetous of power, and a despot by taste. All this may perhaps be true, but the inferences which have been drawn from these truths are exceedingly erroneous. It has been imagined that General Jackson is bent on establishing a dictatorship in America, on introducing a military spirit, and on giving a degree of influence to the central authority which cannot but be dangerous to provincial liberties. But in America, the time for similar undertakings and the age for men of this kind is not yet come. If General Jackson had entertained a hope of exercising his authority in this manner, he would infallibly have forfeited his political station and compromised his life. Accordingly, he has not been so imprudent as to make any such attempt. Far from wishing to extend the federal power, the President belongs to